Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer here, as promised, for a little bit of open forum. You can ask him anything you want, and anybody can ask, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, whether you're human or not. We don't care. Just call 888-318-7884. You want to know about Jesus? We love talking about Jesus.
Can I give a quick caveat? I think if you're not human and are capable of calling, that's totally a Jimmy Akin call. He would be so excited.
You probably should wait till Jimmy's on. Yes, that's true. That's true. Although there's a whole movement now, Joe, to declare animals to have human rights. We talked about that. We already talked about that. Yeah, never mind.
Talked about it with trees, but there's a whole other, like Peter Singer. The danger here is once you eliminate the line between humans and lower creatures, it goes in both directions. Like, you might be attempting to raise animals to the level of humans. The inevitable effect is that you lower humans to the level of animals.
Yes. And what I mean, when we're pretty busy in the modern world lowering ourselves to the level of animals, but then once we have an intellectual justification that there's not that much difference between humans and animals, then what's really the value of a human life, or what's really the value of humanity in general? Maybe the planet's more valuable than we are. We should save the planet and get rid of the people.
I was in an online debate about abortion because you know how those are famously productive.
What were you doing that for?
That's
like a bad choice to make.
One of the guys said that he saw no moral difference between eating meat and human flesh. And I was like, I am pretty sure this guy is a vegetarian, but he could be a cannibal.
Yeah, and it was just one of those two.
Like, once you eliminate that distinction and no longer, because I mean, that's pretty extreme, guys. If you really think that horses are on the same level as human beings, that's actually terrifying. That's not like, oh, good for you, you've got such a humane view of horses. It's like, no. This only ends up in one place, and it's nightmarish. You know who noticed this is the ancient Greeks.
Oh,
in
they did?
Book 9 of Homer's Odyssey, he has a really interesting juxtaposition between the lotus eaters, who are vegetarian, and then the Cyclops, who keeps goats as pets, but then eats humans.
Right.
And so what the Greeks seem to have seen, and we see this juxtaposition all over ancient Greek literature, is that vegetarians and cannibals make the same mistake of failing to recognize human distinctiveness. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't be vegetarian for other reasons, but people who are vegetarian because they don't see the difference between eating meat and eating human flesh are literally making the same mistake a cannibal makes.
Yes. Although we have many, there's lots of people that are into being vegans now. It's not even good enough to be a vegetarian anymore. You got to be a vegan. And we love those people, Joe. It's often designed to alienate everyone. Last time you started by attacking Winona Ryder. I don't know if you recall this, but you attacked Winona Ryder at the beginning of the last show, and now you're attacking vegetarians, and I'd like you to stop it.
Only those who are vegetarian for the wrong moral and philosophical reasons. Uh-huh. I was vegetarian for 6 years. I get it. But there are bad reasons regularly used in defense of vegetarianism, and those bad reasons are dangerous, and I think we should call them out.
888-318-7884 is our number. I'm sorry. I guess I'm still mad about the Winona Ryder thing, and it kind of came out. There was a lot of energy behind that, and I'm sorry. I'm going to try to let that go. 888-318-7884, our number, 888-318-7884. It's open forum. You can ask whatever you like of our guest, Joe Heschmeyer. If you want to, if it's a particular Christmas or Advent question, those are welcome as well, because that's what we're celebrating right now. But anything, you got a moral question, philosophical question, something having to do with the Bible, with the sacraments, with the church, with the Pope, or with Jesus himself, 888-318-7884. I probably should also mention, perhaps you have a question about Our Lady of Guadalupe. If you've got a question about Our Lady of Guadalupe, that is welcome as well. Joe, you know why I'm particularly singled out Our Lady of Guadalupe, don't you?
Yes, because you're aware of the liturgical calendar.
Oh, yes. All right.
That's what I assume.
Yeah, I didn't. I wasn't going to phrase it that way.
Yesterday was Our Lady of Guadalupe's feast day. Today is St. Lucy. But Our Lady of Guadalupe was the single most effective evangelist in maybe 2,000 years.
As a matter of fact, yeah, right. Our Lady at Guadalupe, it's a miracle of evangelization. When I think about it, I'm reminded of Dr. Carrie Gress's book, and who I just love and admire, Dr. Carrie Gress. And she has a book called The Marian Option. And the basic point of it is, if Mary's doing something, join her. She's got this. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. Whatever she's doing, that's the thing to be doing. The ultimate proof of that is Our Lady of Guadalupe. Do you know that most of the Americas are Catholic today? From the tip of South America to the northernmost frozen tundra of Canada, most of the Americas are Catholic.
Yeah, well, even more striking, it's not just that they're Catholic. It's that they're Catholic and became Catholic really rapidly, right when it seemed like evangelization efforts were going to totally fail here. That, like, when you trace the history of the attempt at Spanish colonization and evangelization, it prior to 1531, it was pretty disastrous.
Yeah.
That, you know, the Aztecs were not in any kind of rush to become Catholics, and the Spanish were increasingly convinced they were up with something truly demonic that, you know, they were facing down, and they just weren't succeeding.
No.
And then after Our Lady appeared to Juan Diego, you have something like 10 million conversions, which is just unbelievable. And it really changes the whole course of human history.
I mean,
without exaggerating, it would be very hard to tell the story of especially Western history, like this hemisphere's history, without talking about Our Lady of Guadalupe, because you can't explain why there are all of these Catholic countries, basically everywhere south from, you know, Texas down to Chile and Argentina.
Yeah. And you know, when she did it, 14 years after the start of the Protestant Reformation.
I think about that a lot, that we know Christ says, like, I can raise up sons of Abraham from stones.
Yeah.
And so after the people of God reject him, the Jewish people reject him, he then chooses, like, the Gentiles, who are, like, the most hated people. Well, after all these respectable Europeans reject him in the 16th century, what does he do? He takes these people that would be, like, their worst nightmare to encounter, like the Aztecs, and he turns them into pious Catholics.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Let's start with Ben in Canada. You know what? Our Lady Guadalupe, patroness of Canada, too. Listening on Catholic.com. Ben, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi there. Quick question for you, then I go to run.
All right.
What is the moral, what's the moral perspective behind vaccine mandates at Mass? Our diocese here in Kamloops, British Columbia, is now making vaccines mandatory if the parish exceeds 50% capacity. So what's the moral teachings behind?
Well, do you have to bring your card? You have to bring your vaccination card with you?
You have to show proof of vaccination and photo ID.
Hmm.
Wow.
Wow.
I like that you just say quick question.
Yeah.
Thanks for the quick question. Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
Joe, go ahead.
It's a really messy issue for a lot of reasons, because you have here the intersection of several things. As a general rule, Catholics believe in obeying civil law. We also believe that vaccination is something that needs to be voluntary, though, that you can't force someone to inject something in their body they're not comfortable with. Now, with that, that prohibition is not entirely absolute. And so there are situations in which you can be required to be vaccinated, for instance, in the military, where the kind of benefits of vaccination or the benefits of this outweigh the kind of individual right you have there. They're like, bodily autonomy is not an absolute, as we know from, like, the pro-life fight. All of that is wrapped up. Additionally, canon law is wrapped up. In canon 834, it talks about how individuals have a right to the sacrament. And what it says first it says the church fulfills its sanctifying function in a particular way through the sacred liturgy, which is an exercise of the priestly function of Jesus Christ. In other words, like, the church is who she is because of the Mass, and she is living out who she is during the Mass. And then it goes on to say, actually, in 843, the sacred ministers cannot deny the sacraments to those who seek them at appropriate times, are properly disposed, and are not prohibited by law from receiving them. Now, not prohibited by law there refers to not prohibited by canon law. You know, if you're living outside the faith, if you've, you know, publicly defected from the faith, if you're excommunicated, those kind of things. But if that's not the case, and that's not the case here, then you should be able at appropriate times with the proper disposition to receive all of the sacraments. And so weighing all of those things together, I think there are a few things that could be said. One is this creates more of a priestly duty to strive to create masses that are under 50 people, that may mean celebrating more masses than you would normally say. But to create a situation where unvaccinated faithful are unable to receive the body and blood of Christ just indefinitely, it seems like a very serious moral problem that I don't think there's good grounds for. It's almost like putting your own church under interdict. It's a very serious kind of penalty that doesn't seem to be warranted by the circumstances.
We'll leave it there. But he said a quick question, so you gave him a pretty quick answer, a couple minutes there, Joe, and I appreciate that. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
EWTN Radio is growing. Are you an experienced radio producer looking for an opportunity to help forward Mother Angelica's mission of evangelization? We need a passionate, multi-skilled, talented professional who can manage all aspects of producing world-class radio programming. You could be the newest member of the EWTN Radio family. If this is you or someone you know, email a resume and cover letter, including salary requirements, to humanresources@ewtn.com.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Sitting next to me, Erica Olson, director. She's an executive here at Catholic Answers, by the way, which is much higher than anyone else in this room, in this whole studio. You have a higher, you're the highest authority in here. So if war breaks out, you have to take command. And here to talk to us about the conference.
Heck yeah.
It was a huge success last time.
It was.
Even huger next time, we hope.
I hope so. We were just blown away by attendance at our last conference, I think. I was expecting like 300 to 400 people. We got over 700 people. And next year, like you said, is going to be just absolutely blow it out of the water. I think we're going to get to your 1,000, Cy.
Easy.
You keep calling it. I mean, there's a max capacity of 1,000 people, and I think we're finally going to get there.
I was right. We would have gotten to 1,000 had there not been a thing called a pandemic.
That's true. No, I totally agree with you. Yeah. I totally agree with you. I think we could have made it happen. Because the year before that, in 2019.
It was like 962.
It was 900.
Oh, 900.
Ish.
All right.
Yeah.
900-ish.
Yeah. So I think we could get there. All had right. there not been a pandemic, you're right.
So the theme.
Go ahead.
No, oh, I was
oh no,
say,
Jesus!
Now you have to explain why you just yelled out, "Oh no, Jesus!"
I know.
She knocked
everyone.
Over the crucifix because she was not taking the Lord's name in vain. She was trying to catch it before it hit the ground.
I was trying to save him.
Okay, so look, the Catholic Answers Cruise, September 22nd through 25th. We always do
you
it.
You said cruise.
The Catholic Answers.
You really
want
to go to that? Really want that to come back?
Allow me to recover. Catholic Answers Conference. I'm not the one that just yelled out the Lord's name on air without explaining it. September 22nd through 25th,
yes.
Next year here in Southern California, where it is just beautiful. I realize we got some rain this year, and I maybe oversold the fact that it never rains at that time of the year, but it won't rain next year.
We can't promise.
But maybe it will. Special early bird pricing is happening right now. You just put the promo code EARLY in when you visit CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Yes, you get $50 off.
Among the speakers will be our own Joe Heschmeyer. Do you have any idea what you're talking about? The whole conference theme is on the Eucharist, Joe. Do you know what you're talking about, or are you still thinking?
I think it's going to be on the connection between the Eucharist and eschatology, like the resurrection body,
right.
Its relation to the Eucharist.
Very good, because that's what the ancient church made that connection, that the
well,
this
and,
is the
and
food
Jesus
of life.
To make it in John 6, like, if you eat this bread and eat, excuse me, if you, like, eat my bread and drink my blood, whatever.
Eat my flesh and drink my
raise,
blood.
There it is. Yes. I had it. It just wasn't coming out like I wanted it to. Then you'll raise up on the last day. Like, he's making that connection actually repeatedly in John 6, and I found it really curious. And then Gregory of Nyssa has a really good exposition of it. So does Augustine. So does Cardinal Ratzinger. So,
and now Joe Heschmeyer will.
And Joe Heschmeyer debuted at our last conference as a Catholic Answers apologist to rave reviews, everyone. Like, he was the talk of the conference. And so if you're going to come to see anyone, you need to come and see Joe at our conference. He was such a hit. And our lineup is just incredible. We have all the Catholic Answers apologists along with Joe. We have Carlo and Trent. And I think Tim will be making his comeback by then. And then we have Christopher Check will be speaking for the first time in several years from the conference.
And Father Hugh Barber
will be speaking.
I'd go just to hear Father Hugh Barber. I guarantee you it will be worth the price just to hear Father Hugh talk about the Eucharist.
Yeah, it's going
to
be incredible. And we have some fun events planned along with the talks and a big dinner gala at the end of the whole thing. So if you haven't bought a Christmas present for your person treat yourself to a really cool Christmas present, it's like I said, there's $50 off.
Present.
There you go.
Oh, well, no,
well,
sorry, I got off track.
You get to go there anyway.
CatholicAnswersConference.com. Use the promo code EARLY. Get $50 off right now. Mm-hmm. CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Thanks, Si.
Well, thank you, Erica. It was a little weird when you just yelled out. But
I'm sorry. I was trying to save the
crucifix. I think we're going to probably EWTN's like, what's going on over there? All right. Everything's okay. All right. Back to the phones. Erica, thank you very much.
Thank
it's always
you.
Nice to see you. It really is always nice to see you. And I didn't talk about your turkey. I've never talked about your turkey on the air.
We haven't. Do we have time?
Well, if we could just mention the name of the turkey real quick.
So my husband raised a turkey from a little chick all the way to full grown for Thanksgiving, and we
killed it.
He did all the things, and we named it originally Anne Boleyn
because you knew it was going to have its
head.
Wow.
Did
you not know that, Joe? That they named the turkey Anne Boleyn. Raised Anne Boleyn from a chick.
Yeah, and then we had to change its name to Dan Boleyn though because it did become a. It turned out to be a boy.
Yeah. It turned out
Can
to be a boy.
Can we give her a free copy of one of our books that explains this?
Yeah. And if you're a donor, you're going to get to read the whole story because there's an article coming out in the magazine about Dan Boleyn. So stay tuned.
Thank you for being here, Erica. I really like Dan Boleyn.
Thank you.
And he was delicious. Bob in Troy, Michigan, listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are up next, Bob. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yes. I want to give you two questions, but I think only one, I was told.
Well, you know what? Now you've made us feel sorry for you. So, we're going to do two now.
Because they both I really need to know about it. One of them is they're not affiliated to each other. One of them is the King David star or the Jewish star. Where did that come from? I mean, I don't find anywhere in the Bible wingy shape, and you know they're being pushed all over. You could see him on the westerns and movies with sheriff and things like that.
The sheriff star is not, I don't think, to represent the Star of David. That's just a regular six-pointed star. But Star of David
like
come? Yeah, it's the same shape. Yeah,
they're both six-pointed stars, but I think size right that they're unrelated. The six-pointed star of David actually comes from Kabbalah originally. There were mathematical properties with the two intersecting triangles and all of this. And so I don't know much about the history, but I know it starts with Kabbalah and then eventually becomes adopted more broadly by Jews as a way of kind of identifying themselves, the need for a distinctive symbol. You know, Christians have the cross, Muslims have the Islamic crescent. And so there was a big push really in the 19th century, like late 19th century, with the rise of the Zionist movement to have like a distinctively Jewish symbol. And then, of course, it takes on the really horrible form with like the yellow star that was put on the Jews in the lead up to the Holocaust as a kind of an identifying marker. And then the State of Israel adopts the Star of David as a symbol of Judaism and its national flag. So it really has become accepted, but it's much younger than David. I mean, it was probably younger than Christianity in terms of a symbol at all, but certainly in terms of being a widespread symbol for the Jews, we see it accepted slowly over the Middle Ages and then in a more definitive way, like in the 19th century.
Okay, Bob, sympathy question. Go ahead with question number two.
Okay. You said something about the Kabbalah. You're talking about like back in King Solomon time?
No,
I mean like in the 4th century onwards my understanding is that the earliest usage that we know of the Star of David is from Apulia in like the 300s or so. So maybe it was used before then, but it doesn't seem like it was, or at least wasn't in like really widespread usage before then.
Okay. The other question is that the introduction of St. Mark, I was able to read it on one of the Bible book I had. I can't find the Bible book, the Nevera Bible. I thought it says in there, that was years ago, I thought it says in there that St. Mark chopped his thumbs off because he wasn't worthy to become a priest because they were pushing him to become a priest. And I just want to know that tradition is it accurate?
I will say only I've never heard that prior to this call.
Oh,
I've never heard of any such thing.
Yeah, I read it in an introduction, something like he chopped it off because I think because you know, in order to hold the Eucharist, you're supposed to hold it with your three fingers, you know, one of your
yeah. It doesn't sound right for a lot of reasons. One of which is that like bodily mutilation of that kind is not holy. Like for a person to intentionally chop up their hand so they wouldn't be able to serve God at the altar, that story sounds very, very suspect. And I feel like I would have read about that if that was a real thing.
Yeah, I tried to Google, I couldn't find it, but I thought I read it in a Bible.
I've got the Navarre Bible, and I don't remember seeing that in there, so I think that might be mistaken.
Bob, I got to say thank you. Going to keep moving. It's open forum. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer. The number's 888-318-7884. And up next is David right here in California. David, we're glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, I had a question. Am I able to get the Eucharist and do the confirmation if I have a child on wedlock?
Yeah, so is this a situation where you've been to confession and repent of maybe the original underlying sin there?
Yeah, so this is like after like I've confessed and all as well.
Oh, for
I've
sure.
Got mixed messages about it.
No, there shouldn't be any mixed messages.
Oh, no,
there
should not be mixed messages at all. Let me be very, very, very clear. Fornication, having sex outside of marriage, that's sinful. But the children that come from that are not sinful. The children that come from that are gifts from God. And so it would be really abhorrent to say you can never, you know, like as long as your child is alive, you can't receive Jesus. That would be psychotic. Because think about all the people who don't have kids or who aborted their kids. It would be incredibly anti-life if the church took the position that we would penalize you for having a living child from fornication rather than just go to confession if you've sinned against God and then treat your child as a gift from God. There's an incredible part in Romans where he says that where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more, that even in the midst of all of the things that we do wrong, God will bless us even in the midst of that. And I think that your child is a beautiful example that even when maybe you've gone astray, God's never given up on you. He's never turned away from you. So please don't let any kind of misinformed Catholics keep you from the great gift of receiving Jesus in the Eucharist.
And you said confirmation, David. You haven't been confirmed?
No, I've been confirmed and everything, but this was like after like I've confessed and everything. I've been up to date with my sacraments and everything.
Yeah. Okay.
So I did my communion confirmation.
Yeah, no, you're one of us. Look, like I got to tell you, man, every one of us has past sins that we're not proud of, and some people's are just more obvious than others. And God, if you are contrite, He forgives you. So don't let that hold you back. You're one of the gang. You're one of the rest of us. Like that's how it is for us all.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you, David. Thank you very, very much. You know what, David? We have a book here that I'd like to send you if you'd like it. It's called The Words of Eternal Life. It's a relatively new book from Jimmy Akin. And sound like such a decent and sincere person. And I think it's a kind of meditation. It's a meditation on our shared Christian faith that you might really like. If you'd like it, just hang on the line and we'll send you a copy. And I really do appreciate your call. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer, Jesus overcomes sin. He doesn't make us sit in it and wallow in it and suffer endlessly. He overcomes sin and restores us back to health.
Amen. I mean, think about the encounter between Jesus and the Samaritan woman. He doesn't say, oh, well, you know, you had sex out of wedlock. You can never be united with me. That's just not how it works at all.
No, nor any other sin. I mean, that we should feel unworthy of the Eucharist, I think, is perfectly reasonable. That we should feel banned from the Eucharist or blocked from it because of past sin, that's a misunderstanding of what Jesus is offering us. He's offering us eternal life and healing.
Absolutely. Yeah, very well said.
Open forum today. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, 888-318-7884. You can ask whatever you like. And you don't have to be Catholic. You don't have to be Christian. 888-318-7884. Although you can be Catholic. You can be Christian. We'll take anybody.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
This is Debbie Giorgiani.
And I'm Jerry Usher.
Join us for Take Two with Jerry and Debbie tomorrow at noon Eastern.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Feeling pretty happy for Advent. Feeling joyful expectation. I think that is the liturgically appropriate feeling. And I am having the liturgically appropriate feeling right now. Joyful expectation. 888-318-7884. That's probably because Joe Heschmeyer's here and he's going to answer a bunch more questions. And that fills me with joyful expectation. Joe, you ready to go back to the phones?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, Rich in Cincinnati. That's in Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Go ahead, Rich, with your question for Joe.
Thank you for taking my call. And I'm probably going to butcher these, but my questions are around I think it's the Nihil Obstrad and the Imprimatur. It's the marks that a bishop has reviewed a book. And I'm just curious about, one, is how important is that when you're looking for, you know, doctrinal material on the faith? And how hard is it for an author to get those? And what would prompt a Catholic author to publish a book without getting those?
Joe answers, I don't think you butchered them. I think different people pronounce them different ways. I'm going to try to pronounce them, Joe, and you tell me if I'm in the ballpark. Nihil Obstrad.
That's how I pronounce it.
That's how you pronounce it? I know that.
That's how I pronounce it.
Because Father always corrects my Latin. Imprimatur.
Yeah, I also pronounce it that way. Look, my Latin pronunciation is really bad. And so the fact that I pronounce both of those ways, no one should take that with any great.
Yeah, Father Hugh's probably listening right now going, that's completely wrong.
All right. Worse, my in-laws are probably listening. My mother-in-law teaches Latin, and so she's probably just like,
all right, so what are they?
Turning the volume down.
Let's take.
Yeah, so the first one, the Neil Obstadt, means there's nothing objectionable in it. The censor looks through and makes sure, like, hey, are you teaching some crazy heresy in here? And so that just says, like, nope, there's nothing obviously objectionable in there. But the imprimatur it literally means let it be printed, which is just the bishop saying, yep, good to go. I'm satisfied that this is, you know, a worthy book to kind of add to the collection. So then the question is, well, how hard is it to get? And I would just say, look, Cy Kellett has been able to receive it for his books, so that should probably answer the question there.
Doesn't seem like the right answer. Somehow that's, I feel offended, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah, no, actually, one of the controversies is that sometimes it's been too easy to get those in the past. Like, you will occasionally find books that have the Neil Obstadt in the imprimatur that are still bad, bad books. That someone didn't do their job in terms of ensuring the doctrinal orthodoxy of the books. But when you have a good diocese, when there's a good bishop in place and a good censor, they do a good job of screening. And so they're helpful. They're not perfect. They're not a perfect indication the book's going to be great. And then the last part is, like, what are they used for? And then why would you maybe not get it? There's a few categories in which you're expected to get it. If you need special permission, if you're doing like a commentary in scripture, you can't just go and like publish your own translation of the Bible. If you're writing on scripture, theology, canon law, church history, or religious or moral subjects, if those are going to be used as a catechism or a textbook, they need these. Otherwise, you're encouraged to get them, but they're not strictly required if they're just for like private devotional reading. So it's advisable in all cases if you're dealing with those subjects. It's mandatory in specific cases. But, and so why don't more authors get it? That's a good question. I think they should. I think occasionally
Go ahead. Oh, go ahead, Rich.
Am I mistaken, though? I thought some of the Catholic the books through Catholic Answers Live, you know, or through the Catholic Answers Press don't have it.
No, you're right.
Okay.
They don't. You have to make application to the diocese, and it's either the diocese that the author lives in or the diocese that the book is published in. So we don't necessarily seek the imprimatur and Nihil Obstadt for all of our books.
Okay.
Again, like the nature of the book and the nature of the intended usage of the book is really important for that. And the particulars, I couldn't really tell you. I've in the past gotten it. I think it's good. But it isn't strictly required.
Okay. I was just curious.
All right. Thank you, Rich. Thanks very, very much. Let's go to Granger in Lincoln, Nebraska, watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Granger. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello. My question is about Mary having a discussion with my uncle, who's a Protestant. I tried to go the route of Jesus honoring Mary is, you know, Jesus and the Ten Commandments honor the mother and father. And he said, okay, well, did Jesus pray to Mary? And I did not know how to answer that.
That's a really good question. And I think it's a really fruitful one. First of all, props to you for having the conversation with your uncle. It sounds like a good, fruitful conversation. Second, I think the angle you're taking in terms of honor your father and mother is a very good one to say, like, look, we are not going to honor Mary more than Jesus honors Mary. That's going to be true in all over the board. If you look at Revelation 12, when we find her enthroned in heaven, no matter what you do in terms of praying to Mary, you're not going to do anything better for her than enthroning her in heaven, which God's already done. So we're not going to outdo him in generosity towards Mary. That's, I think, an important point, because people are afraid that, like, what if we give her too much honor? And it's like, well, he gave her more honor. Why, you know, mixed messages. But third, the question of did Jesus pray to Mary depends a lot on what do we mean by the word pray. So Mary is, of course, alive during the lifetime of Jesus. Now, pray in its literal sense means to ask of something, ask someone of something, or like to request. And so in that sense, like, she's his kid. I bet he prayed to her all the time. You know, there's a cartoon that I saw that says the first rosary is just like the child Jesus saying "Mom" 10 times in a row.
Mom.
Which, if you've got little kids, you get how that is, yeah. Right? Like that's. So in that sense, like, sure, he prays to Mary. We see at the end of Luke 2 that he is submissive to Joseph and Mary after the finding in the temple, that he goes down and, like, puts himself voluntarily under their authority, even though he's the second person of the Trinity, even though he's the master and creator of the universe, that he still submits to their authority. That certainly means that he would be asking them for things. I think anyone who doesn't accept that hasn't really taken the incarnation seriously enough, hasn't really taken seriously enough what it is for Jesus to be fully man, to actually be the son of Mary, and to actually be, you know, her infant, her toddler, her child, her adolescent. And if you take all of that seriously, like, he would regularly have those kind of conversations where he asks her for things. And anyone who's ever been a parent, I think, or a child for that matter, knows what that looks like. So in that sense, yes, I think many Protestants here pray to Mary as worship Mary. And in that sense, no, but we don't do that either. Like, we don't worship Mary. So I don't know if that helps at all, Granger, but hopefully it gives you an opportunity to clarify what you do and don't mean by prayer, and what your uncle does and doesn't mean by prayer.
Okay, Granger?
Yes, that's very good. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. I appreciate the call. The number's 888-31-TRUTH. We head down to Sydney, Australia now. Sherika watching on YouTube in Sydney. Glad to have you, Sherika. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thanks, Ty. My name is Sherika, by the way.
Sherika, I apologize. That
the last Australian caller who called in, he asked if they were from Chicago. So just set your expectations.
I swear,
at
it sounded
level.
Like a Chicago accent to me. At the time, it seemed like a Chicago accent. In context, Sherika, I think you might have been on my team. But please go ahead with your question. I apologize for the mispronunciation.
No problem. Before my question, I just wanted to say, sorry, out of all the Catholic Answers speakers, you're my favorite host. So just wanted to make that clear. So all good with the mispronunciation of my name.
Wait, no. We're not done. We're not done talking, Sherika. Not after that. Joe, you just stay over there for now. Sherika and I are going to have a conversation.
Take this call. Exactly.
This is the best call we've ever gotten. I'm not moving off of this quickly. Sherika, thank you. That means so much to me. It's very, very kind of you to say it. Thank you. And especially since I just mispronounced your name. I love all of you people from Chicago. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
So a couple of months ago, I heard this talk in one of the parishes that, and it was on Eucharist, that when we receive Eucharist, there is a possibility that we also receive Mary, because Jesus received his DNA and nourishment from Mary in her womb. And because the Eucharist is body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ, do we also receive Mary? So that's my question. Is that a heresy, or
I don't think that's a good road. I see what the person is doing there. I wouldn't go down that road. And here's what I think they're describing. The first is, it's certainly true that Jesus receives his humanity from Mary. In terms of, you know, he has a biological mother in a way he doesn't have a biological father. And so in the incarnation, something miraculous is happening with this flesh that's coming from Mary. That is somehow being unified as a human nature with the second person of the Trinity, who already has a divine nature. Second, there is interesting stuff about the relationship between the mother and the unborn child that we're learning in terms of the science, that there's a sharing. There's more stuff that passes between mom and baby than we realized before. And so that women who've previously had a child will sometimes have additional, I'm blanking on the name for it, but basically different means in their bloodstream to fight off disease that's actually coming from their baby, that babies will leave behind for years and years in the mother's system. Some, you can see like an actual biological trace of their having been there. And likewise, of course, you're receiving half of your DNA from your mom. So there's kind of this two-way street in which mother and child remain connected in one sense afterwards. So it'd be more accurate to say that Mary, even after the birth of Christ, for years and years would have had a Christ DNA in her bloodstream, just on the level of being a mother, because that's what happens with moms. That's kind of a cool, really beautiful kind of point of reflection. But I wouldn't take either of those things to mean that when we receive Jesus in the Eucharist, we receive Mary. I think that's a mistake for a few reasons. One is it really does reduce the person to something like DNA. You know, identical twins have the same DNA, but they're not the same person. So we're not receiving the person of Mary. I wouldn't go that way with it. I think that misunderstands something about the human person of Jesus and the human person of his mother. I like what they're trying to do, but I think there are better ways of acknowledging the humanity of Christ and its relationship to Mary without going down that road.
Shrika, what do you think?
No, that's a wonderful answer. Thank you for clarifying.
Thank you very much for the call. I'm just curious. You said you heard this at a parish talk, and I thought that you weren't doing any of that stuff in Sydney.
No, we are having a lot of revival and renewals in Sydney, so it's an exciting time.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it, because the impression we have here in the U.S. is that Sydney is, like, shut down for the COVID. But I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, Sydney is pretty good in terms of, if compared to other states in Australia, Sydney is pretty good. If I have to compare it with Melbourne, that's completely shut down. And you must have read the news as well that Melbourne had the longest lockdown. So it's not in Sydney. Sydney is much better.
Well, all right. I'm glad to hear it. I'm very glad to hear it. We got to take our break. Shrika, thank you for the very kind comments and also just the very pleasant conversation. It's very nice to get to speak with you. We'll take our break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer right after this.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, friends. Jonet Williams here. Join me every Wednesday on Women of Grace Live as I welcome New Age researcher and blogger for Women of Grace, Sue Brinkman. Sue and I will be talking about all the wacky things that could distract you from your faith. Psychics, yoga, Reiki, crystals, acupuncture, Ouija boards, tarot cards, and astral traveling are just a few of the stranger things we discuss. That's why we call it Wacky Wednesday. So join us every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer. So glad you're here with us. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I'm in trouble because in the first hour, I was having so much fun having Steve Ray on. I forgot to read the ad that Carrie said to me this morning. Don't forget to read this ad. So now I'm going to read it really with a lot of enthusiasm because I was supposed to read it before. It's digital mega sale time. We realize Christmas is less than 2 weeks away, and time is running out to get gifts ordered and delivered on time. No problem. Just go to digital this Christmas. To make that easier, we've marked all our books, e-magazines, digital videos, and MP3s down to $1, $3, or $5. Nothing over $5. You'll also find our School of Apologetics courses at their lowest prices of the season. What are you waiting for? Carrie literally puts the sentence, "What are you waiting for?" in every ad. Get over to shop.catholic.com right now and find something digital for that someone special on your list. Alma in Imperial, California, listening on 95.7 FM. You are next. Go ahead, please, with your question for Joe.
Good evening, gentlemen. My question or concern, I guess, earlier Joe mentioned something about being vegan or vegetarian. There's something wrong with it or morally wrong with it. Not quite sure. I kind of started in on the conversation halfway through. My question is there something wrong as a Catholic to be vegan or vegetarian? Or is that just...
No. And I'm glad you asked that because it gives me a chance to clarify what I'm not saying, what I am saying. Of itself, there's nothing wrong with being vegetarian or vegan. It depends on the reasons why and kind of the arguments given in favor of it. What I was trying to say is that the vegetarian movement regularly employs arguments that eliminate the distinction between humans and animals. And so, for instance, the phrase meat is murder. Meat is not murder. It may be wrong to, you know, certainly animal cruelty is wrong, but it's still not murder because animals aren't humans. And so in as much as the dialogue in favor of vegetarianism and the dialogue in favor of veganism sometimes employs arguments that ignore the distinction between humans and animals, that's what I'm trying to call out. Someone could acknowledge that humans and animals are different and still choose not to eat animals. That's totally fine. But if the arguments in favor of it blur that line or ignore it, that's where we get into a moral problem.
Okay. Yeah, no, because I love a good thick, juicy steak. But I have friends or I know people that are vegan or vegetarian. And being Catholic, I was like confused when you said that. I was like, wait a minute, you mean there's actually something wrong?
It depends. Yeah, so I should have been clearer about that. It depends on why you're doing it. There are plenty of good reasons to do it. There are just also plenty of bad reasons to do it.
I also have to confess
that I joke around with Joe probably more than I joke around with most people because I find Joe hilarious. And Sometimes I lead him into trouble
I went down this road intentionally. I actually wrote my STB paper in theology
on
this exact question, on the connection between vegetarianism and cannibalism. The problem is I'm trying to summarize like a capstone paper in like a few minutes when it could take a lot more explanation as to where the image of God is sometimes lost in vegetarian discourse.
But I do think a great part of the point of the New Testament is eat whatever you want. It's not in a, like you can't eat human flesh, but in general, if you want to eat meat, eat meat. If you don't want to eat meat, don't eat meat. If you want to eat meat, sacrifice to idols, go ahead and do that. If that bothers you, don't do it. But there's no more dietary laws for Christians. Was that
right?
It's
very true. And I think it's important to remember Jesus eats meat. And so I read a Christian vegetarian book that described meat eating as a suboptimal moral choice while acknowledging Jesus had done it. And it's like, no. You don't get to claim you're more moral than Jesus. That doesn't work. So,
Alma, does that all satisfy you?
That answered my question. Thank you very much for your time, gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you for letting us clarify that. I really appreciate it, Alma. I'm going to try to get another caller, 2-3, on if I can. So let's go to Tony in Coldwater, Michigan, listening on 91.5 FM. Tony, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes, sir. I have my question all lined up, but a previous caller changed what was more important. I'd like to know the statistics, and I know you computer people can find them, of women who abort their baby and women who have their baby who lives longer on the face of the planet Earth. I'd be curious to know that statistic. But my question was, because I am a Protestant, I've called you before, got very satisfactory answers on deep theological questions.
Okay.
Here's one that I differ with you. In the book of Revelation, the Apostle John more than once fell at the feet of an angel because he was dazzled by his brilliance, and the angel said, "Do not do it. See that you do not do it. I am a fellow servant just like you." Yet you Catholics pray to an angel named Michael and even call him thou instead of you like us humans do, like he was more than us. Can you explain that?
I'll do the abortion one. You do the St. Michael one.
Okay.
Because I don't believe there's a great deal of evidence one way or another. And I know that will bother people that I say it because sometimes the evidence is exaggerated. Although there is clearly some evidence that abortion might lead to an increase in breast cancer in women because of interrupting the hormonal cycle of the pregnancy is the theory, but I don't know that there's a great deal there. But I don't think in general there's a great demographic difference as far as life expectancy goes for women who have undergone abortion and those who have not. Joe?
Yeah, I'll take
St. Michael
angel
the Archangel, defend us in battle.
Yes. So there's really like three or four aspects of that. One is you mentioned the 2 points in Revelation where he's talking about John falling down at the feet of the angel, but he does more than that. Revelation 22:8 is very clear that John actually falls down in worship and the angel warns him not to because he's merely a creature. That means like, by all means, like we do not worship St. Michael. That would be wrong. That would be immoral. It's not wrong or immoral to talk to an angel. We see John talking to the angel all throughout Revelation and not being rebuked for that. So talk to the angel, great. Worship the angel, no. Like don't do that. But there's a big difference between those two. Like we're talking right now, and I don't think either of us is worshiping the other one. So they're just two categories differently. So when we talk about prayer, we mean conversation. We don't mean worship. Then the second part is recognizing that angels are actually elevated above humans. And let me nuance that a little bit. There's a reason when angels appear, because they are in the presence of God, because they're these incredible spiritual beings, they have to say things like, do not be afraid when they see us. We see this all over scripture, that the response humans have is properly one of awe and being kind of dumbstruck. That's not wrong. That's not sinful, and that's not worship. That's recognizing the awe, the awesomeness of what God has created. And that's really good. Now, the flip side to that is that when we're glorified, we're made even above the angels, but we're not there yet. So then you mentioned going to Michael with thee and thou. And I get to share one of the things I find really cool about the English language. Thee and thou is originally the informal language. When you wanted to speak to someone who is above you or speak really formally, you would actually say you. So eventually the formal you replaces the informal thee and thou and thy, which was originally the way you would go to people kind of in a friendly way. In our popular imagination, we have it totally inverted because prayer uses thee and thy and thou. But the reason prayer uses thee and thy and thou was to show that like God is our friend. And so even though, you know, you'll see this in Spanish, for instance, there's the vosotros form, you know, the formal second person. And that is only used with like, you know, the king or a superior, or your boss or your parents. You don't use it with God. You use the intimate form with God. It's a beautiful image that we should have an intimacy with God and an intimacy with the saints and the angels. So actually the point of saying thee and thy and thou with Michael isn't to show this cold distance, but it's actually meant to show a warmth and a familiarity there.
I feel like we're heading back to Tony, see if that answer satisfied. And we only have a few seconds, Tony, but did that satisfy you?
And I studied the English language, and I agree with you that if you go back to the very original, like the original King James, that you or me, neither one could read right now, thee and thou did kind of change places. But because people talk, okay, let me give you another, for instance, Eucharist. I couldn't tell you the meaning of that word. I know what communion means. Catholics use, why is Latin a holy language when the Bible was written in Greek, Hebrew, and a little bit of Aramaic?
Joe?
Oh, well, actually, Eucharist is Greek. It means Thanksgiving. I think much more could be said. We say Eucharist usually instead of communion for clarity, because we use communion to mean like the relationship within the church, as well as receiving sacramental communion and everything else. So Eucharist is not meant to be technical or heady. It's meant to clarify what kind of communion we're describing.
And there's a long history with the Latin, but you're asking two men who are terrible at Latin why the church is so focused on Latin. So maybe we're not. I call when Father Hughes here, because he really does know that Latin. Joe Heschmeyer, I enjoy my time with you more than I should, and I should be more professional when you're on. Thanks for doing the hour with us.
My pleasure.
We'll see you tomorrow. 2 hours of open forum, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.